an update on the radio station that canceled Third Opinion, and the terrifying tale of Israeli journalists arrested in Nigeria while doing a documentary on a Jewish tribe there. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion podcast, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
And I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us today. A lot going on this week. Let's get our WMNF news out of the way. First off, let me say, for those of you who live in Tampa, I know people live away from other areas, Lorene had a great article in the Tampa Jewish Press talking about the anti-Semitic radio station that we believe is broadcasting in Tampa, WMNF, using public money to broadcast anti-Semitic tropes all the time, and yet the station took us off the air because they didn't like us negating any of that. The show was started on the radio station because the former general manager, Craig Kopp, thought it needed to be balanced off because he said the station, in his mind, was anti-Semitic, the former general manager. And speaking of former general managers, Rick Fernandez,
yes. Who is no longer there.
The general manager who was part of the cabal that helped force us off the stair, off the air, off the stairs, off the air, is no longer with the radio station. He resigned to take another job. It is a mess there. It truly is. I won't go on much more. Here's the, I say this every week. Here is my heartburn. They are using public dollars to produce programs that are anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic, in my opinion. It is just terrible. And they're using your dollars and my tax dollars to do that. Still working on trying to deal with that. And let me just say one other thing. The Florida Department of Education has been terrible with the public records requests that I've put in. They are just horrible, but that's a whole other story for another day. We will let you know what's going on with the public money. I know this is our deal, but I'm not upset, again, about being off their radio station. I'm upset about a anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic program being broadcast that, in my opinion, should never be on the air, and we're paying for it. Okay?
Okay. I'm staying out of the public records request commentary. However, you know, for those of you who are listening who are not local to the Tampa Bay region, why it matters. I mean, this is, you know, when we've got a real issue of growing anti-Semitism in the far left and the far progressive left, where, you know, we've been talking about this for several years, where it really, when you look at it, if you put it side by side to anti-Semitism, what we see in the far right, it's really no different. I mean, they sound exactly alike. And it's very frightening to us that we see this growing movement, you know, that's growing through intersectionality and also just lack of education, information. I mean, I think people want to support other groups and human rights issues. And what you've seen is this political movement, the Free Palestine Movement, which is a political movement. It's not a human rights movement. It's a political movement that's fully intended on literally destroying the only Jewish state, Israel, in the world. I mean, they try to delegitimize, single out, demonize, attack, spread lies, false accusations. And for the most part, most people are uninformed. And so they don't recognize these lies like ethnic cleansing and different things as distortions and as falsehoods, because they don't know any better. I mean, most Americans don't really spend a lot of time, you know, studying the Middle East and the Israel-Palestinian conflict and different things. I mean, and so they hear these things, and because I think, you know, especially as Jews too, you know, our hearts are bent towards justice. I mean, what did God command of us? The prophet Micah tells us to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before our God. And, you know, and I think, it's disturbing. This is why it's sort of a bigger issue, even though Mike and I have talked about it, because it's local to where we live. And, you know, in addition to the podcast we were on that radio show to respond to specifically, we were on that radio station specifically to respond to a lot of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel rhetoric that was coming out of other shows being played on the air through that program. So, So and, I think and, that's and, why and, we continue to talk
right,
about
it. Exactly. And I think it's really important to differentiate the progressive far left from liberal-leaning Jews, which most surveys show most Jews, they're like 75%, are Democrats, or voted Democratic in the last election. But I'm left to center. I'll be first to admit I'm a socially liberal, fiscally conservative. I'm left to center, but I do not agree with the far, far left progressive folks who are Jewish, who are anti-Israel, and there is a distinction. And sometimes I feel as if people lump, I don't know if it's progressive, but left of center Democrats in with the far, far left. And there's a real distinction between the two, and that causes some problems, I think.
Well, there's huge distinctions. I mean, the progressivism is very different from liberalism, classic liberalism. And I mean, even on free speech, I mean, that's a perfect example. Like, progressivism, which is really sort of the Democratic Socialist Party of America, right? The DSA and their platform, you know, as we even spoke of last week, both Jeremy Corbyn and Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib spoke at their biannual convention. And, you know, they don't believe in free speech. If they don't like your speech, they want to shut you up. And that's what, like, whether you're a communist, a socialist, a fascist, that's what dictatorships do. They shut up and shut down voices that don't agree with them, that they don't like. And where liberalism always supports free speech and different things. So it's different values, and it's something that people need to be educated and informed about. And hopefully you're learning something by listening to our show and the different reports we're bringing you every week. I mean, I think it was interesting this week. You know, we saw, for instance, in England, one of the largest British, I think the British Actors Guild, it was a British Jewish, you know, one of their actors unions during the attack on Israel, when Hamas attacked Israel in May of this year, you know, the president of that union, you know, they were joining for a huge protest in London and calling for people to stand with the Palestinian people and stop Israeli terrorism. I mean, it was insane, the stuff that they were saying.
And a lot of Jewish theater goers said, hey, you want our money? You want us to come to your plays? Cut it out, guys.
That's right. That's right. And so they wrote a letter of protest. I mean, they were super angry, you know, about this comparison of Israel to Hamas and terrorism and all these things. And you know, so there was a huge movement of British goers, you know, sending demands and complaints to this Actors Guild, which, by the way, not the first time. I mean, the Actors Guild in England, this is not the first time. This has been going on for many years where they have boycotted Israeli actors and actresses, or have uninvited them when there's like these huge productions going on. Israel has been uninvited. You know, this is not uncommon in England right now. And, you know, what was also interesting this past week, you know, we see even in Toronto, for instance, our neighbor to the north, in Canada, there's been growing anti-Semitic vandalism. It's been like sort of one thing after another in the Allgemeiner this week. They were talking about in Toronto different synagogues being attacked with graffiti and swastikas.
Yeah.
And the defacement of these synagogues. And I think this is really important because it's been nonstop.
B'nai B'rith of Canada wrote a letter saying that we've got to do something about this, because we've had stories almost every week about anti-Semitism in Canada. Wasn't it in Canada also where they asked to not grant a status to a professor at the University of Toronto?
That's right. So another Toronto issue. So this is a German professor. Her name is Valentina Azarova. There was an open candidacy at the university, and B'nai B'rith in Canada, you know, it's kind of like the equivalent of an AJC, the American Jewish Committee here in the U.S. They were complaining, saying you cannot extend an invitation to this woman to come and teach at the university. I mean, this is a woman who has direct links to the Popular Front of the Liberation of Palestine, the PLO, which is a terrorist organization. You know, she's She's written editorials
in support of them, absolutely, and is a avowed anti-Semite. There's no question about it. And right now, she's having problems getting a visa into Canada. But they say if she clears, they don't want to see her come to the university. It would put a stain on the university.
Right. But we should say at least one positive thing coming out of Germany, which I thought was a really nice story this week. Jewish German life, a sign of faith. So again, the Allgemeiner talks about the University of Potsdam is opening its first synagogue in 83 years.
First synagogue since the Holocaust. Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought that was really a lovely story. There at the university, which obviously there's a need there because of the Jewish students. So to me, that was a positive story. Germany, it's a good thing.
I think probably the biggest story, though, this week, obviously, is Afghanistan.
And how
that's going to affect the Mideast and things going on. Now, it's terrible what's going on in Afghanistan. It breaks my heart. But quite candidly, Laureen, I think we should have been out of Afghanistan 19 years ago. Once we got Osama bin Laden, I have a really good friend who's a full-bird colonel who sent me a text. He said, as soon as we got bin Laden, we should have been out of there and it would have had the same results as we're seeing right now. We just gave the Taliban more time to organize. And when even the Trump administration, and I'm not a big fan of the Trump administration, had negotiated a deal for us to be out of there by May 1st, and had Biden reneged on that deal, now all the people who are criticizing him for pulling the troops out would have said, hey, Trump put together a deal, and now you're going back on the deal. It was a no-win situation.
I'm not going to defend Biden or the Department of Defense or the Joint Chiefs or anyone else who gave him advice on this. It's an abomination. And I will tell you this. I'm really upset about this. I actually don't, because this is not about colonialism. It's not about America. No, it's about a nationhood and people, innocent civilians in that country who relied and trusted us and counted on us for that protection, that shield of safety around them. And when I sit here and I know now that the Taliban is literally going door to door and hanging people, killing women are burning their degrees so they won't be executed. It is a tragic situation. Let me tell you something. It's not just horrible, Mike, but it's happening.
But it would have
in
happened
in the month of Elul.
It would have happened no matter when we left.
That's not true. I disagree, because look at Japan and look at Germany. People would have said that 30 years ago about that, and that's a lie. Let me tell you something. It is the month of Elul. We are in 40 days, the 40 days of Teshuvah. We are in a time when we are supposed to be seeking God's face, a time of repentance, a time to come before him. And let me tell you something. The one thing God hates, and he is very clear about this in our Torah. He says to act justly, love mercy, and he tells you, do not turn your back on your brother. Do not turn your back on the widow. Do not turn your back on the orphan. Do not deny food and clothing to the hungry, to the poor, to the sheltered. Do not do this. Do not
do
it. Do not do it.
Let me ask you a question.
That I feel so strongly about this.
Wait, let me ask you a question.
As a Jew, I feel like we have, like I feel like as a Jew for America, like I feel like I have to stand and repent for my own country for
wrong.
What we've done. I feel like we had the
wrong.
Blood of these people on our hands.
We did a bad exit. I will be the first to admit we did a bad exit, but let me explain.
It's not
something.
Just a bad
wait. Let me, give me a, give me a, give me, give me a,
are dying.
Let me get, wait, hang on a second. What I am told from sources I have talked to, that the Taliban was getting ready for an offensive. And if we didn't leave, we would have had to send more troops into Afghanistan. There hasn't been a death in Afghanistan from U.S. troops in something like a year and a half. I am not ready, personally, to sacrifice another American's blood in Afghanistan, in a nation where the president took millions of dollars within 2 days of us saying we're going and absconded with that, where the military laid down its arms immediately.
They're terrified.
Wait,
the Taliban's so violent.
But
we weren't there.
Were you? Are you willing to shed more American blood That's what would have happened if we had stayed. We would have had to increase our troops. Not going to do it.
I know you think that's what would happen, but we didn't. But you know what? We will now never know.
Well,
really.
No, but that's okay. But some of the experts have told me.
And other experts disagree with that. But let me tell you something. The one thing we do know is that there's blood. There's literally people are dying right now. Men, women, and children are dying, are being executed right now. And we're responsible for that. I feel responsible.
But okay, here, let's bring it back into why this is important to us as Jews, because Afghanistan is right in that powder keg of terror in the Middle East. And now there is concern, and perhaps rightfully so, that the other Arab countries and even Israel can't count as much on the United States. That's why it obviously it's an issue that both of us feel strongly about, but that's why it fits within the parameters of this show. But we can't be nation builders everywhere throughout the United States. The world has changed so dramatically that we just can't do it for a country that doesn't want our help. There was a great
I think there's a lot of people in Afghanistan, good people who wanted our help and who needed our help. And now you had an entire generation grow up with our help, and now they're left defenseless, and we just sort of abandoned them into this hellhole.
Something like 75% of Americans wanted us out of Afghanistan. And here's my prediction. I could be wrong.
But no one desired this.
I agree. It was not done well. But let me tell you, in 6 months, I believe this will not be an issue. It won't be.
Let me tell you something. In 6 months, this will still be an issue for me. Yeah. I will not. This is something. I have cried too many. I've been so... And in the time of Teshuvah, when we're sitting where we are now, knowing what the Torah says and what we're supposed to be reflecting on right now, what we should be doing, you know, we should be making tzedakah, we should be caring about people. Like, it's something I cannot take lightly.
We didn't belong there. We went there to get Osama bin Laden. We got Osama bin Laden.
We went there to get the Taliban. I mean, you know, but regardless, Mike, you know, but we...
It's sort of like Vietnam. The French couldn't do it. The Russians couldn't take care of the Taliban. We couldn't take care of the Taliban. It's a godforsaken country.
But it wasn't about taking the Taliban. This was just about providing security for the innocent people who were living there.
Well,
and who were trying to establish a government and a way of life. And who were, you know, you had women in education, women who were receiving degrees.
It is horrible. I agree. But
I mean,
I don't think we can be the policemen of the world anymore.
I don't want to see any more American troops.
I've had friends that have gone to Afghanistan, scared the hell out of me while they were over there. I don't want to see any more troops going to Afghanistan.
This was more about a humanitarian issue. But going back to your point about Israel, you know, what we saw, this is exactly what happened under the Obama years with the Iran deal. You know, many of our friends in the Middle East and the Arab Gulf states, you know, felt abandoned by the U.S. You know, it did drive relationships and made them closer with Israel. And I think there's a lot of question now about, you know, it does re-raise this whole issue of, you know, can we rely on the United States? Can we trust our ally to be there for us? And this is a big deal. When, you know, America relies upon these relationships and our allies when they feel that there's a lot of, you hear this openly. It's not just behind the scenes grumbling. This is open conversation. And of course, China mocking us. And China is a huge threat to the world.
Pompeo is the one that signed the surrender agreement. You're blaming Biden for all this. Biden has some complicity. Pompeo signed the surrender agreement with the Taliban. Pompeo was taken with a picture of the new president of Afghanistan, who was let out of jail by Donald J. Trump. So don't put it all. You cannot put it all on Biden. Biden has you think Trump had nothing to do with this? Come on, Laureen.
I'm not saying Trump had nothing to do with this, but I'm thinking, it's a very different approach, and he had very bad advice, and he took the advice of his joint chiefs, which, by the way, they should all be fired and removed from office. And he did it in a way that he should not have, because first of all, that was his desire to do that. And he did it in a, he did not do it with good advice. He was ill advised, and he did it in a poor way, and he abandoned people. And like, now we also have American citizens, by the way, who are there, who are on the ground in Afghanistan, who are hiding for their lives, who are in danger.
It's a horrible situation, but we should be out of
Yes,
there.
But you cannot. No, but this, I put this 100% on Biden, the Joint Chiefs
how
Department
can, wait, wait, how can you do that?
Failure.
Wait, Laureen, we're getting
failure.
So far. Trump signed, Pompeo signed the surrender agreement. Trump released 5,000 Taliban from prison, including the man who is now president or the head of the Taliban. So how, wait, let me finish this. How can you say that Trump had nothing to do with this?
I'm not saying that Trump had nothing to do with this, but
you can't put it all on Biden. It was not handled as deftly as I would like to have seen it done. But there is, there it was all there. No. There. Okay. Let's get to something you and I can both agree. We can.
Who I adore, our Israeli cold gymnast. Yeah. I love her. So she had a great, she was interviewed, you know, so she is a little religious. She said she was very nervous. She realized that she carried the weight of really the country on her shoulders when she got to Tokyo. And she would say the Shema before every routine. Yeah. And I just applauded for that. I adore her so much. And so, you know, I'm very excited for her, and she's been celebrated and welcomed home literally as a hero back in Israel. So super proud of Linoy.
Yeah. Let me tell you a funny story about the Shema. My daughter was teaching Sunday school at Sheir HaZedek. For those of you not in Tampa, it's the largest Reformed congregation in Tampa. So she's teaching Sunday school to kindergartners. I mean, this is a gazillion years ago. And she's teaching them the Shema. And these kindergartners are sitting in a little circle together. And she said, now this is the most important prayer for Jewish people to learn and know and always remember. So one little kid raises his hand. He goes, well, I'm Jewish. And then the little kid next to him goes, well, I'm Jewish. And they're a Jewish religious school on Sunday morning. Every little kid didn't realize that everybody in the circle was Jewish. And my daughter, she told Rabbi Bernholtz that. He just slapped his head. He said, yeah, maybe we need to do a better job of telling them why they are here. Anyhow, that's my favorite Shema story.
That is so cute. I love that.
Hey,
so,
look,
by the way,
you go ahead.
Can we talk about Africa really quickly? So, you know, we shared the good news about 2 weeks ago about Israel being welcomed back into the African Union, which is really important. I mean, Israel has been so involved with so many African nations with trade and helping with water technologies, with farming technologies, with medicine, and so many things. And so the South African government, which, you know, it's so disturbing to me, but the South African government, and you and I talked about this, like the president of South Africa, very anti-Semitic, but the chief justice of South Africa loves Israel. And he came under tremendous attack about a year ago because of his stance with Israel. But the South African government is very anti-Israel, and they are now lobbying, and they're now engaged in this huge lobbying effort to object to the African Union's commission to grant Israel observer status in the AU. So this is going on right now. So I'm very disturbed by this. I'm not happy about this at all.
Yeah.
Because I think about how,
and there are a lot,
this is just,
it's horrible. There are a lot of Jews in South Africa. I was in Cape Town and Johannesburg, I don't know, 3-4 years ago or something like that. Met a lot of Jewish people there. But this is terrible. But anti-Semitism is everywhere. And that leads me to our next piece. We have a great piece. You know, I have questioned, why do we have so much anti-Semitism? Why is it around? What can we do about it? We have a really good piece about who is to blame for anti-Semitism. Let's take a listen.
Whose fault is anti-Semitism? This is probably the most controversial question about anti-Jewish prejudice. Conservatives blame liberals, liberals blame conservatives, Christians blame Muslims, Muslims blame Christians. So who's right? Is there a specific community that drives anti-Semitism? The answer is no. That's because anti-Semitism has always been spread by offenders across the ideological spectrum. What is the worldly religion of the Jew? Huckstering, declared the godfather of communism Karl Marx in 1843? What is his worldly god? Money. Not long after, Marx's contemporary Wilhelm Marr, the right-wing German nationalist who mainstreamed the term anti-Semitism, he was for it, declared that Jews didn't share the same sense of ethics as non-Jews because they preferred to accumulate wealth. Marx and Marr didn't agree on much, but they agreed on those self-serving, money-grubbing Jews. This anti-Semitic agreement didn't just hold among political rivals. For centuries, the Christian Church persecuted Europe's Jews as Christ killers and infidels, while Voltaire, the Enlightenment's sharpest critic of the religious establishment, repeatedly assailed Judaism, calling Jews an ignorant, stupid people. These examples are just the tip of the anti-Semitic iceberg. Throughout history, people with entirely opposite worldviews, from Nazi Germany's Adolf Hitler to the Soviet Union's Joseph Stalin, have somehow found a way to agree on one thing: persecuting Jewish people. On the surface, this is pretty confusing, but it makes sense when you understand that anti-Semitism predates our modern categories and stems from something far more fundamental: the human inability to tolerate difference. Jews are the world's oldest minority that has refused to conform to the majority culture. For thousands of years, Jews have persisted in their unique practices and traditions. They were too stubbornly Jewish for religions like Christianity and Islam that sought to convert them, too religious for atheists and free thinkers like Voltaire, too closed off and clannish for the internationalist left like the communists of the Soviet Union who put Jews in gulags, and too worldly and widespread for the nationalist right who slurred them as corrupt cosmopolitans undermining the state. As an ever-present minority, Jews have been perpetually scapegoated for the majority's problems, constantly cast as untrustworthy and accused of serving their own interests at the expense of society's. In the biblical book of Esther, the villain Haman tells the king, "There is a certain people dispersed among the peoples, who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them." This 2,000-year-old expression of anti-Semitism could have been written yesterday. Take this recent broadcast by True News, a right-wing Christian news outlet that was accredited by the Trump White House.
"That's the way the Jews work. They are deceivers. They plot. They lie. They do whatever they have to do to accomplish their political agenda."
Now listen to this 2015 interview with Jewish Senator Bernie Sanders by Diane Rehm on NPR, the polar opposite of True News. You'll recognize some familiar themes.
"Senator, you have dual citizenship with Israel."
Well, no, I do not have dual citizenship with Israel. I'm an American. I don't know where that questioning came from. No, I'm an American citizen, period."
Jews sought to escape their minority status by founding their own state, Israel. But now anti-Semites just accuse Jews everywhere, like Sanders, of disloyally working for Israel as part of a global conspiracy to control non-Jewish countries. These insinuations find their way from the internet into everyday interactions.
"Mr. Cardin looks like a regular white guy, nice guy, whatever. But in actuality, he's a Jewish white guy. And if the public was informed of that by C-SPAN, I think they would take his comments differently. Because this guy is Jewish, that means that he is concerned about Israel."
Eric, I want to give the congressman a chance to respond to that.
You know, I normally am pretty tolerant to people who ask questions, but I'm not to your assumption. I take great offense to that. This country, our loyalty is to America. Our concerns are to America.
As they have throughout history, conspiracy theories about Jews undermining society have deadly consequences. In 2018, a white supremacist named Robert Bowers, who claimed Jews were scheming to replace whites with brown immigrants, massacred 11 worshippers in a Pittsburgh synagogue. In the years that followed, another white nationalist attacked a synagogue in California, while black extremists with entirely different worldviews shot up a kosher supermarket in New Jersey and stabbed religious Jews at a Hanukkah gathering in New York. The point here is not that anti-Semitism exists equally in all these communities. It's that no community is immune to anti-Semitism because no community is immune to the instinct to stigmatize difference. Nowhere is this more apparent than Europe, where Jews surveyed from Spain to Sweden report experiencing serious anti-Semitism from all directions. This testimony reflects real-world bigotry. Whether it's Poland's Christian Conservative Party passing laws to repress studying the Holocaust and Polish complicity in it, or Hungary's nationalist leaders leading a state-sponsored campaign demonizing Jewish financier George Soros, blaming him for the country's problems and comparing him to Hitler, or Britain's preeminent left-wing party failing to stop pervasive anti-Semitism in its ranks under leader Jeremy Corbyn, or Jews in France being subjected to countless violent attacks at the hands of Islamic extremists. As you can see, anti-Semitism is the ultimate equal opportunity offender. So why does anti-Semitism continue to flourish across the spectrum? The answer is simple. People only tend to police anti-Jewish bigotry when it comes from the other side, not their own. It's understandable why this happens. After all, it's much easier to condemn the prejudice of people you already despise and disagree with. It's a lot harder to speak up when the bigotry is coming from your friends and allies. But think about it. Where do you have the power to make change? Among your friends or among your enemies? In your community or in someone else's? Yet too often, our national conversation about anti-Semitism consists of people trying to bounce anti-Semites from parties they weren't invited to. Conservatives policing progressive anti-Semitism. Progressives policing conservative anti-Semitism. And so on. You don't have to be an expert in anti-Semitism to see why this doesn't work. So how can we stop this from happening and start fighting the anti-Semites instead of each other? The secret is this. Focus on the anti-Semitic ideas expressed, not the individual expressing them. If we train ourselves to recognize anti-Jewish sentiments, rather than getting distracted by their source, we'll be much more successful at identifying and uprooting the hateful ideas across the board. But if we pick and choose which anti-Semitism to care about based on who says it, and give our own community a pass, the bigotry will continue to spread unchecked. Because the truth is, casting anti-Jewish prejudice as a specifically left-wing problem, or right-wing problem, or Christian problem, or Muslim problem, is really just a way of saying that it's someone else's problem. The only people who win this argument over who's the bigger bigot are the anti-Semites, who continue to spread their hate while their supposed opponents point fingers at each other. To truly combat anti-Semitism, we need to stop thinking of it as other people's problem and start confronting it as our problem.
So the sad answer is anti-Semitism has been around forever. And
so all
we can do is speak out, and that's one of the reasons I'm proud to do this show. And there's the dogs in my house. All of a sudden,
they're agreeing with you. They're agreeing.
I'm sorry,
they're Jewish
gang.
Dogs, everybody.
Yeah, dogs. They're Jewish dogs. That's right.
So, by the way, some sad news this week. We had a young Denver yeshiva student who was shot and killed in a horrific crime. So there were four young men in Denver that were. I guess they were sort of on a crime. Night, and they were, carjackings, burglaries, shootings, etc. And this young boy, he was outside of the yeshiva, and unfortunately, he was shot and killed, and died. So his name is Samuel Fussell, F-U-S-S-E-L-L, Samuel Fussell. And I believe his funeral is actually tonight. We're recording this on Friday, so Friday night. And the police said they're not sure yet if it's a hate crime, but
they have a funeral on a Friday night.
Well, Friday.
You threw me.
not on Shabbat, no. But during the. But it's really sad because they're saying they're not sure if it's a hate crime. I'm thinking to myself, these guys have just gone on a crime spree and they see a young yeshiva boy who clearly is dressed as a young yeshiva boy in front of a yeshiva, and they just randomly shoot him dead. They don't rob him or do anything. Yeah, I think that's a hate crime.
Yeah, I would say. Hey, listen, Lorene.
It's a genius to figure that out.
No. Hey, we got to take a break. We're way over time. I'm missing our break. This is the Third Opinion Podcast.
Third Opinion has a website. It's thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can give us a suggestion for a future podcast. You can make a comment about a podcast you just heard, or you can listen to podcasts you may have missed. That website again, thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to the Third Opinion Podcast, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
We talked a couple of weeks ago about some Israeli journalists who went to Nigeria to do a documentary, and they ended up being arrested.
In horrific conditions.
In unbelievable horrific conditions.
We should talk about that. It was about the Igbo tribe. The Igbo tribe is a tribe in Nigeria of Jews. These are Nigerians who have practiced Jewish traditions, customs going back hundreds, if not thousands of years. So they were there, just like there's a tribe in Ghana, the Ghanaese, that do this. So you got to remember the Jews were all over North Africa and we were doing trade and everything. And not to mention also the Lost tribe. So there's questions, was this a Lost tribe? Were these just Jews who had settled there doing trade throughout North Africa? And so they were there to spend time with this Nigerian tribe, the Igbo, and sort of document their lives as Jews living in Nigeria as this very tiny minority. And they were arrested by the Nigerian government, horrific conditions. And so, Mike, you've got this amazing clip on them.
That's right. What do documentary people do when they have something horrible happen? They make a documentary. They talk about it. Really? So they listen to this. This really is frightening what they live through. And these are the three Israeli journalists who were held captive. Fortunately, they've been released. But this is what they had to live with when they were arrested.
We didn't know anything going on in the world. We didn't have any means of communication. We didn't understand why we were there.
They basically treated us like animals.
The words written there were, "Dear God, please allow me to experience happiness one more time during my life."
We became the story, and that was absolutely never our intention.
My name is Rudy Rockman. I'm a Jewish and Israel rights activist, and I'm also the executive producer and host of the We Were Never Lost documentary series. It's a series that is set to tell the stories, struggles, and aspirations of lesser-known or disconnected communities of Jews around the world. Our first season is to take place in Africa, and we were just in Nigeria filming our first episode. Unfortunately, after 2 days, we were illegally held by the Nigerian government's internal security service and held in cages for 3 weeks. We are here to set the record straight of what we went through and what actually happened.
My name is David Benaim. I'm a journalist and I'm a field producer and producer on the We Were Never Lost series.
I'm Noam Liebman of Kavanaugh Films and the creative director for We Were Never Lost. So first you may need a bit of context to understand who the Igbos are and why we went to Nigeria in the first place.
Now, the Igbo people are a people with a rich history, diversity, and a lot of culture, and have very similar experiences that other Jewish communities have had around the world that are known in the mainstream, whether it's through persecution or overcoming challenges. They believe to be descendants of a tribe of Israel, specifically of Gad. There is a large community within the Igbo population that has either preserved elements of their Jewish culture, their Jewish heritage, or has come back to their Jewish culture and heritage. And some of them are even now second generation born, where all they know is being Jewish. And we were coming to Nigeria to document specifically their stories. Where do they come from? What have they experienced? What is their history? What are their aspirations? What are their culture? Do they want to stay living in Nigeria? Do they want to come back to Israel? What is their story? And that's why we came to Nigeria.
Okay, so starting from the beginning, we arrived in Nigeria and spent the first 2 days filming in a village called Ogidi.
The amazing community that welcomed us with open arms, like cooked us food and introduced us to their way of living their Jewish life, the way they were praying every single morning.
Even though we only had 2 days, we got to experience how charismatic, intelligent, hardworking, and knowledgeable in Torah that this community is. At the end of our second day of filming, we were notified that there were some online posts going viral that had used images of us. We could see that they had completely fabricated stories, calling us Mossad agents,
associating us to a movement that is seeking to liberate Biafra and to fight against the Nigerian government, which of course we had nothing to do with.
Some agent in Israel have arrived. They are here to indeed restore the Biafra nation.
Before the British Empire had come and colonized Nigeria, the Igbo people were an autonomous population in their own lands. And when the British came, they united the different ethnic groups and tribal regions, from the Yoruba to the Hausa and Fulani, and also the Igbo population. Around the 60s, there was a Biafra War, which is a war of independence for the Igbo in the southeastern region of Nigeria. They were independent for a few years. Millions of people were killed and starved to death during that war, and eventually they lost and became part of Nigeria again. Afterwards, there was a lot of tension and bad blood between the communities, and the Hausa Fulani, which are the majority and those that are always in power, have been discriminating the Igbo population. And since then, there are still movements that seek to separate from the rest of Nigeria. Now, apart from this political movement to achieve self-determination for the Igbo people, the reality is that the vast majority of the Igbos have nothing to do with fighting or physically pushing for the liberation of Biafra and are normal people living within Nigeria.
These bloggers had seen we were bringing a Sefer Torah as a gift to the youth community and proceeded to make a fake claim that our efforts were connected to the separatist movement and that when a Torah arrives, it's a sign of their movement. This claim doesn't even make sense because there are already several Sefer Torahs throughout the region.
The DSS decided to get involved. The DSS is the Secret Service, the Interior Defense of Nigeria.
They show up at our hotel at 7 a.m. Friday morning with about 10 heavily armed men in black ski masks and tell us that we need to come with them.
They took our phones, they took our passports, and they took our freedom for the following 20 days.
Of course, we were coming in with no bad intentions and we were innocent the entire time, so we didn't think much of it. We thought that we'd just come in for an hour, answer some questions, we'd show them what we're about and what we were planning to do, and that we'd be able to continue and to proceed with the project. Eventually, they started taking us one by one and interrogating us in ways that they would just accuse us when asking a question of us being there for malicious reasons. Of course, we had nothing to hide, so we all answered with the truth that our project had nothing to do with any sort of political movement, that we were there to document the beautiful lives and the culture of the Igbo Jewish community in Nigeria. So it's Friday night and we've realized at this point that we're not going to be able to get out and do Shabbat where we had planned to do. We're in a holding cell and everyone's leaving for the weekend and we wanted to do Shabbat but we had no grape juice or wine. So we did the kiddush over a grape that we found and the motzi over some crackers that we had. And this is how we spent our first Shabbat in Nigeria.
Now, Rudy, David, and I know that we have embassies of three very powerful countries willing to fight for us, but this is not the case for Nigerians who get arrested. There was a non-Igbo man initially taken into custody with us, and when he asked our captors not to yell at us, the interrogator threatened him by saying, "I can make you disappear." This is the type of abuse of power we witness firsthand, and the realization that there's just no accountability for this injustice.
24 hours later, in the morning at 7 a.m. after sleeping on the floor, we were rushed into a van.
They did not want to tell us where we would be. They did not want to tell us where we would go. They just said, get in the car. The drive was horrendous, very dangerous, driving extremely fast, almost intentionally trying to sort of intimidate people by driving in their directions in order for them to be afraid. A lot of us were afraid for our lives.
We had no clue if the world knew that we were taken. We could not communicate with anyone.
After 9 hours of nonstop dangerous driving, we were dropped off at the DSS headquarters in Abuja and brought to a caged holding cell.
And when we say cage, we mean literally a cage. It was a circular room that you can maybe take 3 or 4 steps in each direction behind bars.
And then we asked our captors, "Are we under arrest?" They said, "No." "Are we being detained?" They say, "No." So we tell them we refuse to willingly enter this cage. For about 20 minutes, they stood around not knowing what to do because they didn't have the authority to put their hands on us. Eventually, another officer comes in, screaming at his men that they're embarrassing him, and orders them to physically throw us in the cage.
First 5 nights, we didn't have lights, we didn't have AC, it was dark, it was hot.
No furniture, no beds, we're forced to sleep on the tile floor.
We were sweating, there were bugs, there were bottles of urine all over, it smelled very bad.
The cage itself looked like what you could imagine in Hollywood movies, besides it was not a film. We were living it completely.
In the morning, when the sunlight finally illuminated the room, we saw writing all over the walls from previous prisoners. The words written there were, "Dear God, please allow me to experience happiness one more time during my life." And another one saying,
"Please remember me once I disappear."
We could see the bars on the walls of the people that were counting the days.
For 6 days, we didn't shower. We were eating only bread and crackers.
They basically treated us like animals and no hope of knowing at all what was going on the outside. We had no clue why we were being arrested.
Finally, after 5 days there, the Israeli ambassador managed to come with one of the consulates from the American embassy to see us. This was the first time that we made contact.
And we finally were able to know that the outside world kind of understood what our situation was.
Told us that they were doing everything that they can to get us out, that they were trying diplomatic means, and that they were in communication with our families, which was a breath of fresh air that people knew where we were, and that at least our families knew the location of where they were keeping us. They also managed to speak to the people that were holding us, the DSS officers, and agreed to bring food from Chabad, a Jewish organization all around the world, specifically the one in Nigeria, that agreed to provide us with kosher food. So by day six, it was the first time that we had a real meal. We were finally allowed to shower. Now, when I say shower, I don't mean we go into a room with an actual shower. I mean we go to the bathroom or the bucket that they use to either clean themselves because there's no toilet paper, or to actually clean the bathroom itself by pouring water on the floor. And taking this bucket, we would fill it up with cold water from the sink and we would dunk it on our heads. And that's how we would shower there for the 3 weeks that we were being held.
I am immunodepressive and I need my medication daily. If I don't, my life could be in immediate danger, especially in the kind of situation that we are being held on.
His medication, along with all of our equipment and luggage, was left at our hotel 900 kilometers away.
And 5 days without my medication can be extremely dangerous with my condition. And we kept on telling them that, and we kept on telling them that that was essential that I get my medication, but they would not react.
The DSS doctor scribbled down the name of the medication and tells us, don't worry, we'll find some. And we're explaining it's a unique prescription customized for him. It's very expensive. You're not going to find it in Nigeria. And if you don't take this seriously, you're going to have the death of a foreign citizen on your hands. And their response was just, calm down, don't worry.
He was feeling very afraid that he might catch something. So he was taken by the French embassy and he was also hospitalized and finally was able to get his medication.
I was sent back every single morning for days to get questioned. Like, the fact that I had to go back inside knowing the way we were treated over there was actually more damaging to me than just the arrest itself.
Me and Noam continued in that room, and after a week we were changed to another cage that was slightly bigger but had also another two cellmates with us. Those two cellmates are accused of doing a terror attack in Abuja bombing in 2014, and the other one of purchasing weapons illegally. At the end of the day, we don't know these people. They could try to harm us, they can try to do something. So the first week being there, we even walked around carrying scissors from my toiletry bag that I had, and we put it in our pockets to make sure that in case one of them or both of them were to attack us, that at least we'd have something to defend ourselves with. And this was kind of the day-to-day life that we went through. We didn't know anything going on in the world. We didn't have any means of communication. We didn't understand why we were there. Several times, me and Noam looked at each other and were like, how did we get here? Accused of all sorts of things, not even officially charged or arrested, so we don't even have human rights to lawyers, in horrible and horrendous conditions, and we just couldn't understand how our lives ended up here at that moment.
We knew that Nigeria's own laws state that when someone is brought in as a suspect, the DSS has 48 hours to arrest or release them. They interviewed us for hours on end, took written and video recorded statements, they hacked our phones, they did literally everything in their power to try to find one shred of evidence they could use against us for an arrest. Before the trip, we understood that the government is not friendly to the Biafra movement, but we couldn't have imagined that they would be unable or unwilling to differentiate between those involved in the IPOB separatist movement and Igbos who just want to live a Torah-based Jewish life. In the end, we didn't receive our freedom for 3 weeks. Almost the entirety of this time was spent just sitting in a blank room.
No form of mental stimulation, no reading material, no news, no nothing going on other than being trapped in a room that was completely disgusting and looking at each other and not knowing when this would end. We didn't know if we would end up being there for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years. We didn't know if people were actually fighting for us. We didn't know if we'd be able to get a lawyer, if something would happen where they would take us and something bad were to happen to us. We were living completely with the fear of the unknown.
I'm a journalist, and one of the most important rules is that you never become the story. Here, we became the story, and that was absolutely never our intention.
We weren't able to create the film that we set out to make. The opportunity was completely robbed from us, and there's no way we'll be allowed back into Nigeria. But if you know anything about the Jewish people, you'll know that we are not ones to give up on our aspirations. This injustice has only increased our motivation to share the stories of the Igbos, and the project will continue.
And this is the occasion for us to go back to exactly what our purpose is. Talk about the Igbo Jews from Nigeria and all the different communities that we are going to explore for the future of We Were Never Lost.
We'd like the world to understand that we were there to focus solely on the Jewish communities. And we hope also through this video that the Nigerian government can understand that if they are fighting against movements seeking to separate from Nigeria, they shouldn't be targeting every single Jew and every single Igbo in Nigeria.
The Igbo Jews welcomed us with open arms, and I will always remember this. And that's what I will keep with myself all the time. And also, I really want to say that I left with two friends, the We Were Never Lost team, and I came back with two brothers, and that's pretty incredible.
During our 3 weeks in detainment, we had no ability to stand up for ourselves, but many people, in fact, tens of thousands of people, stood up for us, including our families, including the diplomats that got involved, including several other individuals.
I was able to see the strength and the force of all different chancelleries, the embassies, all the families, the friends that were really working tirelessly behind the scene to help us get out from there.
And also the thoughts and prayers and actions of tens of thousands of people who follow our work, who follow our project, and who are there for us when we couldn't be there for ourselves.
Our end goal here is not just to make beautiful films about remote Jewish communities, but to bring these diaspora communities to the consciousness of Am Yisrael so they can begin to be understood and reconnected with. If you'd like to support this project, please visit wewereneverlost.com.
Pretty scary. Let me tell you, as a journalist, it's more and more dangerous for journalists around the world. South America has some of the worst incidents of journalists being killed, but fortunately they came out okay, or at least I'm sure they're mentally scarred forever. But wow, that is just. It turns your head upside down, saying, "What is wrong with these people?" Oh, speaking,
but you know,
yeah, go ahead.
Makes you appreciate living in America, though.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, some of the things that I said on TV, if I said those in some other countries, I would have been thrown in jail. You know,
you would have beheaded, thrown in jail, tortured.
I mean, I criticized a lot of politicians, from the governor, I mean, you know, and for whomever. And yeah, so that's really something. But, you know, I said South America, something cool happened in Argentina, which hasn't always been the friendliest Jewish country in the world.
It's not. What happened?
What happened is... Unfortunately, they wanted to commemorate the 100,000th COVID death, and what they did was take the Jewish tradition of putting rocks on the graves of people who had died from COVID. It's taken straight from Judaism, and I don't know who came up with it, but it was sort of acknowledge one of our traditions that they wanted to do to celebrate that. So, like I said,
it was kind of nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very unexpected for Argentina, which definitely does not have a favorable history towards Jews and Israel.
Yeah, I would say. Hey, Paul, how about this one? Did you see the Larry David Alan Dershowitz fight?
Wait, what? No.
Oh, yes. They live in the same town in New England, and they ran into each other in a grocery store, outside of a grocery store.
In New England? I thought Larry David lived in Santa Monica.
Is it Santa? I could be wrong. I thought it was New England, but I could be wrong. It doesn't. But anyway, he started screaming at Alan Dershowitz, "I hate you, you're a horrible human being, blah, 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 blah." Dershowitz said he has lost a lot of friends because of some of his stances and all. But it was a public screaming match. And Dershowitz finally said to Larry David, "Come on, Larry," I guess they've known each other for a long time, and he said, "We can talk." And Larry David, the creator of Seinfeld and what's his other show? I can't think
Curb.
Of it.
Curb.
Yeah, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah, said, no, we can't talk. And before we run out of time,
I love Curb Your Enthusiasm. curb your enthusiasm with Larry David, but I also love and I have tremendous respect for Alan Dershowitz.
I know you do.
So.
I know. I think he's lost.
I'm in a pickle. Okay. I don't think so. He's so sharp. He's got a great podcast. I love listening to his podcast.
Okay. Let me tell you the feel-good story of the week. Scarlett Johansson, who is drop-dead gorgeous, just had a baby with Colin Jost.
Her second one.
Her second one.
She's also a South African Jew. So yes. Mazel tov, Scarlett. But you know my favorite two story to me? So because we have to throw sports in there. We had no sports this week. Well, I take that back. We had Linoy. So the Italian tennis star.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Who knew? Camila Giorgi. She is Jewish. She's this gorgeous blonde hair Italian tennis star, and her favorite book is The Diary of Anne Frank.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the Anne Frank house?
I know you have, yes.
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't talk when I walked out of there. I really couldn't. But we'll have to save that story for another time, because you hear that music? You know what that means?
It was an exciting week.
It's always fun. Hey, thank you for listening. Please tell your friends about our show, our podcast. It's available wherever you can get your podcast. If you didn't like the show, don't tell them about it. And we'll see you next week. This is the Third Opinion Podcast. I am Mike Deason.
Lorraine Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.